This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. How uncommitted did Washington Democrats decide to be? We're going to touch on that in a few minutes. And more, the whole week gone by with my panel, Seattle Channel host and producer Brian Callinan. Welcome back, Brian.
Great to be here, Bill.
Political analyst and contributing columnist Joni Balter. Hi,
hello,
Joni.
Hello there. Good to see you.
Good to see you, and good to see the stranger editor Rich Smith again. Hi, Rich.
Hello, hello.
Watch us, by the way, on YouTube. Just search KOW Public Radio, and you can see the show. A visual feast it is. First of all, I have a declaration to make, and you've probably seen this coming, because first it was the scare that the Super Bowl was rigged for Taylor Swift to endorse Joe Biden at midfield. Then there was the upset that we can see baseball players tucked in shirt tails. Now we learn the monarchy might be withholding details of the private lives of people we'll never meet. And so I'm declaring that as of today, we have no actual problems. We have solved everything, and it's these things are all we have left to talk about. This is our farewell show. There's no more news, unless we can think of any other issues. Is there anything else we could talk about this week? Is there a new movie set in Seattle where a character starts out in one neighborhood and walks someplace that the locals know is actually too far away to walk? Could that be a... That would be an outrage.
I can't wait.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm already boiling just thinking
yes.
about it.
Or a movie supposedly set in Seattle that has the wrong water foliage and trees.
Yes, that would
Did
be
you
news.
See that
not
one?
On my watch.
Did you
not
see that one?
Not on our watch.
Not today, baby.
It doesn't
it
get past.
It actually was on your watch.
Okay. All right. Well, here's something. Actually, here's something genuinely of import, I think. The sheriff of King County is refusing to enforce the new camping ban in Burien, the latest version of it. She is challenging the ban as unconstitutional, and Burien is threatening to quit paying the sheriff's office to enforce its laws.
Just said very based.
Very yeah. What is
defunding
happening?
The police?
Defunding in a way. Joni, what's going
big
on?
Big time haste makes waste. You know, Burien already had passed a camping ban earlier that was was going to the courts for that part of it, and then very hastily last week they passed an added amount of verbiage in a new law that creates some buffer zones and just makes it more complicated about where you can pitch a tent and where you can't. And it came with, I'm told by the county executive's office, with this map that was hastily put together and has like asterisks that say, you know, this can be edited. So it's really leaving a situation whereby, and I'm not saying this happened, but someone could fall asleep on a park bench and be in violation of this law without even kind of just knowing it. They just fell asleep because there's not enough clarity on it. It was rushed through too quickly. I feel that the sheriff's office is actually right to ask for some clarification before they enforce this. Like why, you know, another example, why didn't Burien sit down with its own, because the sheriff's office provides the police service. I don't know
yes,
if everybody
they're contracted
knows that,
with the city.
For Burien. So if you have your enforcers, don't you think you'd give them a quick call or kind of a quick sit down Zoom thingy to just kind of this is what we're planning. Do you have any issues? And what, if anything, should we take into consideration before we rush to pass this thing?
It is something that they have been wrestling with for years. The city of Burien has.
Fair enough.
To be fair. But
fair enough.
They have said also that in talking with their city attorney, they feel confident about this. Now, is that going to stand up in court? I don't know. I just know that the city of Burien is already facing a lawsuit from three people who are challenging the lawfulness of this this
of the
law they have
ban.
In the books. Right, of that very first ban. So there's a few different things circling around here, and I just wanted to take it big picture because there are so many different legal issues surrounding this very point. you know, you've got a situation here where there's a district court judge that could potentially rule on this King County issue. And then you're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, who will be taking up a case, this City of Grants Pass versus Johnson. They're going to be taking that up in April. There's a date set for that.
Taking up, but not necessarily ruled upon.
Potentially, yeah. Potentially. I hear what you're saying. But do we wait around, I guess, is the whole question here. Do we have to wait for all those different legal pieces to fall into place before enforcement happens, before officers get paid, et cetera?
I just want to say that I think it's extremely funny that these people, these council members who were elected after the reaction to the pandemic fallout in 2020, are now defunding the police, threatening to defund the police, okay, because the police won't enforce their unconstitutional sleeping ban. And what you're talking about, what all these courts are deciding, the substance of it is, how mean can we be to poor people? Where can we put poor people who don't have a home in the cities? And this story points to the larger story that we've been discussing ad nauseum for the last 10, 15 years, which is small cities pretending like they don't have a homelessness problem, trying to push all of the homeless people out to their edges, into Seattle, wherever, just not here with my nice blonde daughter and my big, big house, etc. And at the end of the day, we know what needs to happen, right? We need to give these people houses, not hit them over the head before sending them to a jail that doesn't exist.
One of the key things here is that Burien doesn't really have enough shelter.
Right.
And because they don't, they
does,
do
yeah,
run
does.
Into the crosshairs of these federal court cases that are very substantive, and they affect many cities throughout the West until we get a resolution.
And
so,
why don't...
So the wrong thing to do was to rush in with an additional ban. King County was willing to enforce the existing ban. Once you added
even though
all
they don't
these
have
vagaries,
shelters, because
they were like, you're out of boundaries. We don't know what the boundaries are. We're going to get a ruling.
But there are other cities with camping bans. Edmonds, Bellevue, although Bellevue at least has a shelter, but Mercer Island. Mm-hmm. So are we just talking about Burien here?
No, because when the rulings come out, whenever they come out, hopefully this spring, all the cities will have to abide by those rules.
Yeah.
Do you have shelter if you're trying to ban camping? Can you make the required adjustments?
I mean, it's not been for lack of trying. You know, the county and various entities have tried to site shelters and larger affordable home projects in these areas, and the cities have stood up and blocked them and tried to keep them out. So,
And there's an affordable housing piece to it, too. I've read this in The Stranger. I've read this in The Times all over the place. When you talk about this continuum here, it's not just here are people homeless that are sleeping out on the street on benches or whatever else. There's an entire range to this. There's low-income housing that needs to be built here. There's a lot of different things that affect this problem. The visible homelessness that we see in the city of Burien is all over the place. And I think back to the early 2010s. I remember when former council member Mike O'Brien was bringing up this very topic. Can we actually slate out certain parts of the city where it's okay for people to sleep? That was a huge debate back then. I think it's still going on. Is it the city's job to actually say, okay, here it's okay to sleep, here it's not? The city of Burien is wrestling with it now, and I'm not quite sure what's going to happen with this, but these court cases are going to keep
pushing
on going.
Pushing people around and pushing people who live in tents around cities. We've been doing this for the last 15, 20 years. It doesn't seem to be working very well.
But I have one more question about this, maybe, before we move on. The King County Sheriff is no longer elected. They are appointed by the King County Executive, who is on the progressive side when it comes to homelessness. Burien is claiming that the sheriff is politicizing this, didn't consult with their city, I think at least implying, if not saying, that the county, you know, up to the executive is politicizing this. Is there anything about this that is a partisan move?
You know what, I want to be honest, I'll probably get in trouble for the next sentence, so everyone will listen when I say that.
At first,
when I looked at this, I actually thought, this is County Executive Dale Constantine trying to be terribly woke. But the more I looked into it, that was my original take on it. I thought, well, why? I think the sheriff folks are right.
Yeah.
Why would you enforce something? Then you get tangled in the next court case. Why would you enforce something that you think is sort of getting out of bounds? Yes, I believe the cities have a right.
Well, Burien would say, because that's your job to enforce.
I know.
Enforce
I believe
it.
The cities do have a right. They put a lot of money into these programs. I believe the cities do have a right to try to get a handle on this, but they have to follow the law. It's that simple.
It also suggests that passing a camping ban is not a political thing to do or not an ideological thing to do. It's a conservative ideological thing to do. It's something we've done before. It's something that we know doesn't work.
Well, they're saying, Burian is saying, yeah, it's politicians are running Burian and they pass this, but that it's not law enforcement's job to decide that they don't like it and don't want to enforce it.
Right. That's and I've talked to different cities about this when it comes to these camping bans, and it's something that a lot of them have wrestled with. I remember talking with some people out in Mercer Island about it. At least what they're coming forward with, take this for what you will, they're saying, all right, if we can have at least an interaction with this person who is sleeping on a bench or whatever else, our law enforcement's going to be kind of our first line of defense to do that. If we can make that interaction happen, get them in a service, then we've done something. That's what the camping ban does. Now, when you see camping ban, I think a lot of people think a lot of different things about it. But when you hear from these different cities, they're saying, how can we actually make an interaction here that has some legality to it? So they pass these camping bans, and that's how they get that first step there to hopefully make a connection with this person, to hopefully get them the services they need, because police don't want to arrest these people either. I think that's a big point, too.
Okay. And so there's that continuum of how are you helping when you try to interfere with somebody who's sleeping on the streets? How do you respond? And I think that's a whole continuum of behaviors that cities have to deal with.
Okay, we have been saying, since we're talking about police here, we've been saying for years that Seattle wants to hire more police officers. More than half their officers have left in the last 5 years, and they've hired more, but they're still down 375 officers to their lowest staffing since the early 1990s. Brian, how's the recruiting going?
Not great. This is something that's been talked about for many years here, and I have to point it out. Issues with police all around the country. This has been a problem since before the pandemic, officers leaving the job. It's become very focused here over these past 4 years in the city of Seattle, but it's clear to me and it's clear to the city of Seattle, at least with the presentations made to the council this week, that this idea of, okay, let's apply this $7,500 bonus for these new recruits, a $30,000 bonus for people coming in laterally, meaning from other agencies here, it's not having the effect that they want. They're seeing some marginal increases, like instead of six people signing up a month, it's nine people signing, you know, that type
applying.
Of a thing. Applying. That's changing ever so slightly, but it's definitely not enough to make a change with this trend that has been going on. As they hire on more people are leaving. And so this is something they're still wrestling with. And so they're talking about this idea of, let's increase police salaries. We're number 15 in the state. We're behind Redmond, where they're paying people, paying officers $101,000 just to start. Here in Seattle, we're at $83,000. We need to bump up that number. So it's definitely something the council's talking about. They're trying to get creative and say, do we offer free childcare? Do we help with housing subsidies? So I think they're trying to be creative with this. Is it going to work? I see someone nodding.
Incredible move. We're police officers are some of the highest paid city employees in Seattle. They've got a contract coming. They're going to get more. They're going to get more back pay. Don't worry about that. We don't have a cop housing problem, and I don't think that a city council floating housing subsidies so that cops can have a second apartment in the city from their Snohomish home where they actually live is an example of advanced policy. This happened at a city council meeting, a public safety committee meeting this week, where Rob Saka and Sarah Nelson both said, maybe we should consider housing subsidies for police officers to retain and recruit.
But I thought we did have a problem with public servants not being able to afford to live in the city.
With respect, may I disagree with you? Mm. I thought that those discussions were actually pretty productive. Why? Because you only compete for a salary in the category that you're in. Give me a second here. And, you know, Seattle housing for police officers, as Bill just said, it's very high. Supposedly, this contract is going to solve everything on the salaries. The salaries are going to make a difference. But different rhetoric from the city council is also going to make a difference, even if, you know,
rhetoric's
you
free. We've got a $250 million budget deficit we're staring down the face of, and the council is talking about giving government money to cops to pay for apartments to live in.
But just for fun, public safety is the number one issue right now. With this council, six members want to fix this. They want more officers. And if you ask the voters, I bet, based on how they voted in the election of council members, they too want this to be prioritized.
You teed me up perfectly. And what I was driving at so fiercely
was my whole goal.
When you ask the voters what they want, they say more cops. They also say, we want more robust police alternatives to the tune of 70%
countywide.
They are not getting robust police alternatives. We've got some small pilots that
are
underfunded.
A pilot program
we just did a little
called CARE.
The stranger just did a ride along with them. Nothing happened over the course of the 6 hours we were there. They weren't dispatched. They're not being well funded. They're not being well researched or well resourced, and they're not going to be because in order to do that, you have to face down the Seattle Police Union. And this administration, the Harrell administration, doesn't want to face down the police union, who is going to see any kind of police alternative as a takings, and they'll file lawsuits.
One ride along doesn't tell you the whole story.
No, but
I believe that there are some good ideas in sending the mental health professionals out. And so feel free to argue with that.
I think it's a great idea. That's my argument.
Okay.
My argument is that we need to stand them up more.
You can't say they're not trying.
Denver,
you can't say that.
Yes, we can, because they're not trying as hard as Denver and Eugene and Arizona, which has got the federal funding for it, got the state funding for it, standing up these programs 3 or 4 years ago. In the case of Eugene, several more years ago. We could
bottom
do it if
line,
we wanted to. We don't.
Bottom right. line, we need more police officers. We need to be able to talk to them
the police officers don't exist.
In a way that makes them want to work here.
I'd
like to hear from Brian.
I just wanted to say that I think it's important to break apart the issue of public safety. Public safety doesn't having more police officers does not equal public safety. I think we can agree on that.
Sure.
And if you think of it that way, you know, adding an extra amount of officers, that sounds great. But if those other pieces are not there,
well,
like CARE, like these alternatives, then having those extra officers doesn't necessarily make that much of an impact. So I just want to make sure I break apart that monolith, because I think a lot of people might think that way. Oh, more officers. We're going to be more safe. We're going to solve all these different problems.
I think there's a lot more to it.
Hang
on. Would fewer officers help? Would that be productive?
No, of course not.
It might be. I mean, we have had less officers and less crime. We've had less officers per capita and less crime in this city.
More homicides. I mean,
so says you. The data says otherwise.
But I think that leads up to, and I don't mean to steal your introductory line there, but that leads up to why the mayor is doing these public safety summits.
Yeah.
He's trying to bring all the players in. This is Mayor 101, I might add, to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a way of bringing people in to say, you know, try harder. Be more like Denver.
How long do we have to bring people in? How many surveys do we have to get it right? No, we have. I mean, this is just like more Seattle processing stuff to death.
I'm doing results.
Well,
what is the result? More community forums
That's trying to sell the results.
Yeah.
Okay, I have two questions. Number one, why is a housing subsidy, if the city has the ability to raise officer salaries, why are they talking about housing subsidies? Does a $10,000 housing subsidy cost less than $10,000? I don't understand.
It would be a one-time type of a hit rather than something that would be attached to a salary. Is that what you're getting at?
They don't know.
But they can
do
bonuses, so it sounds like a bonus.
Yeah.
I just don't understand.
Potentially, yeah, I think
okay.
it would be
but
the same thing.
These are brand-new council members just trying to say we're thinking of new things.
It's rhetoric. Okay, so, right?
Yeah, but they could also...
Not unless they do it.
they're also writing the budget.
Okay, question number two, regarding the upcoming contract and the negotiations. I thought, in general, police officers, there were lots of duties that police officers don't like having to show up to. They would rather have it be a non-officer alternative. Is that wrong?
No. Well, that's totally true. No, Rich, what do you got?
They talk out of both sides of the mouth. They say they have so much to do. Oh, my gosh, we didn't sign up to babysit, you know, drug-addled people on the street. We didn't sign up to stay around. But then when you try to take stuff off their plate, like, for instance, maybe we don't need a gun and a badge to direct traffic at the Sounders games or whatever, then they contest that. They say you're taking our hours away. Those are very profitable for cops because they get most of their thousands and thousands of overtime hours by being glorified traffic cones. And so they say... Take this off of our plate.
That'll hire a lot of cops.
Well,
that'll
oh, sorry for my
nose.
Rhetoric, police. Please come back. We need you.
But
this is what I'm saying, is that they are political. Police are political actors, to your earlier point. Police are political actors. The executive branch is a political actor. And they act politically. And on this issue, they're constantly saying, take stuff off our plate. We're so busy. And then when you do, they sue.
And I guess that's the part of the contract that I'm paying closest attention to. The dollars are one part of it, but I don't want it to distract from some other important pieces, which include police accountability. And you'll remember the last time this came up in 2018 when there was a big celebration over what the city council was doing. Hey, we've got these new accountability measures in place. Mayor Durkin, unfortunately, it turned into a situation where she was in charge of those, former Mayor Durkin was in charge of those negotiations, and a lot of those accountability measures were bargained away. And so that's the piece of this that
It's hard to discipline and fire police officers.
Yeah,
exactly. Thank you for bringing that up.
Difficult.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. So I want to make sure that we're watching the dollars here, but I really want to make sure that we watch the accountability piece here, too, because in looking at this, this is something that the federal judge overseeing the consent decree that is still lingering over the Seattle Police Department since 2012.
It's this federal oversight because
saying police were using force unconstitutionally. Mm-hmm. That's been around for 12 years now. So how are we going to do this? And Judge Robart has said, I don't want to bargain on accountability here. But I have to say, when we start talking about these different measures and who comes in and at what time and when do these different alternatives come in, there's going to be some bargaining going on. So it's one of these situations where the police going to be happy? Is the judge going to be happy? Is the city going to be happy? How do we do this with the budget restraints that we have right now? There's a ton going on with this other than the dollars.
You're exactly right on that the accountability piece is very important and was the failure of the last contract.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know this.
But how does that change this time around?
But that's the question. The question is they have to have the accountability in there. They absolutely do.
I have a question
maybe
about
this,
too.
Maybe that's why it's taking so long.
For listeners, I want, because I'm not sure I understand, so maybe listeners don't understand. Why the city is us, is the taxpayer, the voters, is in this negotiation with the police union. Why doesn't, if the city wants police to be more accountable, then why doesn't the city drive a harder bargain? Does it all come down to that the concern is that police are going to go on strike? Is that what all this is about?
They can't go on strike.
Why doesn't the city have
the... been going on strike.
So, but why does the city not have the leverage to get whatever measures they want out of the union?
Can I just say, think about the balance of power. You have a commodity that's shrinking, the number of police officers, and you're trying to hire more. So who do you think has a little bit more power in this negotiation?
The answer to your question is that the police, because back pay is on the table in the police contracts, the police are fine holding out for as long as they have to, working with the contract they have to.
It's been 4 years, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so they've got the ultimate leverage here, and the city's over a barrel. And because of public set, because everyone has, whenever you say public safety, for some reason, everyone here is like, we need more cop. We absolutely, definitely need more cop, because that's the knee-jerk reaction. Hmm. The city feels like it's politically advantageous.
It's also a logical reaction.
It's not there's
more
based in evidence.
There's more to it.
Of course there's more to it.
Yeah.
Of course. Okay.
But that's why it's a political decision, and the city's at a disadvantage because the cops are going to get back pay.
Okay, why should we not take a break now? It's a good idea, right?
There's got to be something we can fight about with this one.
We can fight over the break. Don't worry.
Enough said for a moment. We're going to continue to tell you what happened this week and what it means to maybe agree on 100% on our analysis. Who knows what's going to happen next when you stay tuned. Come right back.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Well, you have KUOW members to thank for that. KUOW members make the trusted local journalism and storytelling you hear on this show possible. Become a member today and help support the production of this podcast. It only takes a minute. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm here with political analyst Joni Balter, The Strangers editor Rich Smith, and Seattle Channel's Brian Callanan. Our state primary voting deadline passed this week. I've lived in other states where you can just say, we went to the polls this week. Can't really do that. In Washington.
Okay.
Our state primary voting deadline passed this week. 9% of Democrats wrote in uncommitted. So, Rich, message sent or message not sent?
Not quite.
What message sent?
not quite clear yet, okay. Because we're not quite sure whether or not we're going to be sending any delegates to the Democratic National Convention in August to vote either for Joe Biden or uncommitted delegate round and then ultimately vote for Joe Biden.
And that has to do whether uncommitted can get 15% of the vote in any congressional district. And, of course, we'd be talking about Seattle's 7th congressional district.
Yes.
We don't know if they're going to meet that threshold.
We don't know if they're going to meet that threshold. It doesn't look like they're going to meet that threshold, but there's like 75,000 challenge ballots statewide, and so there could be a kind of like ballot harvesting campaign to get the, you know, get people to challenge those ballots because they didn't want to mark the party affiliation on the outside of the ballot.
Which you have to do.
Which you have to do in order for it to be counted. But statewide also, you know, they did have 78,000 votes for uncommitted delegates, which is more than Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar scooped up in the 2020 primary campaign here in Washington. Both of them campaigned in the state, and the uncommitted delegates campaign really only got started the week of the primary voting.
Yeah.
And so,
although, as you pointed out, Klobuchar and Buttigieg were not on the ballot. They were on the ballot, but they had dropped out of the race just before our primary.
That's right. Yeah, because we have our timing is weird. But you know, this is all to say that if they get north of 100,000 votes, that's 100,000 people who are commenting directly on foreign policy to the president, which is something, because of the way the national security apparatus is structured, we don't get to do very often except through our a congressional representative. And, it kept people engaged. I was seeing some data from Ben Anderstone, a political consultant, who showed that the highest concentrations of uncommitted delegates were in South Seattle, places that are more diverse and younger. These are people who may feel disillusioned with the process, and this uncommitted option gave them a step.
More included.
More included.
And I just got to say that this primary has been, so many people tune out of the primary, and it doesn't really turn into a headline at all. Having this extra piece has certainly encouraged people to pay more attention. I had thought about that because I know we'd been sharing some ideas before the show here, and this idea of, do we move up the primary to an earlier date so that Washington can have more of an impact potentially on these national races? I talked to the Secretary of State's office about this. It doesn't sound like there was some momentum for that for a little while. It doesn't really look like that's moving anytime soon. But the Secretary of State has heard from a number of voters who are not happy with having to write in the party declaration on the ballot envelope there.
Oh, that was a new thing this,
and that's a thing. So it sounds like a situation where the Secretary of State is going to look into, are there some alternative ways to fill out this legal party requirement that's going on, which I'm sure the state GOP and the state Dems aren't happy to hear about. But I think we got some purple people in our state, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, that's for sure. And a lot of people probably didn't like having to make that declaration,
right?
Especially journalists don't like that.
Yeah.
But I'd like to address whether the whole thing about the primary moving up. As you know, we did move the primary up. It was ridiculously late in May, and we moved it up, and there was debate at the time. Should it be the second week in March, or should it be Super Tuesday? And the Super Tuesday folks lost. Now, the parties do control this. And so, they have to decide. And so I think, always going on is different states trying to leapfrog ahead.
Sure.
So they can be relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't think that this was a big number of uncommitted. I've seen Mike the Mover do a little better here once or twice. But it may, look, it's fine to protest. It's fine to go out there and protest, make your point. But what do you think is going to drive voters throughout the state, and especially King County, when it comes to November? The protest is going to feel like, Donald Trump might be our president. Abortion's on the ballot. I think you'll see quite a bit of retreat on that, and that makes perfect sense. The other thing
on the question of when the primary is, I've never really understood. I understand if you're in Iowa and, you're the first, and it's all the state fairs and the fried butter and the journalists crawling all over the place.
Wait, you didn't tell me about that.
Deep fried butter.
Yeah, deep fried butter.
The civilized country.
Yes, right.
But as far as moving, everybody wanting to jockey, like Oklahoma voted last week. Are we all buzzing about the priorities of the Sooner State? Because, Colorado showed us up again. Who cares whether we're a week sooner or how much more relevant?
Well, it only matters if you want to be relevant.
Let
me explain. Let me give you a good example that's on the Republican side. And this is just if, and I apologize for that. If Nikki Haley had come here and the primary was last week, I don't know about you, but I sort of enjoyed her pecking away at Donald Trump. I thought she was one of the most effective critics. So What if we had changed that narrative and been, quote, relevant? I know that's a weird word, and the point is, in the game before the candidates are ready to go to the conventions as the nominees. That's what that's about. Of course, the calendar sounds like, that is so weird. Why are you people talking about it? It's not even relevant. It actually is in certain cases.
It's a huge deal, yeah, up front. I mean, Biden famously for this presidential election cycle wanted to move up South Carolina ahead of New Hampshire.
Yeah.
New Hampshire revolted. They kicked them off of the ballot. There was a write-in in campaign and Biden won anyway. But, you know, the thinking is that if you're first or second, then you – get all the earned media, all the headlines.
Oh,
get
we
the
need
momentum.
More earned media.
Please.
We
yes,
need the
please.
Big Mo.
Is there a sign up sheet for that?
Yeah. And down then with the unearned and then, media.
Yeah. And then Super Tuesday, that's when things start getting clinched, and we all have to use the word clinched.
Clinched.
Yeah, when you clinch the number of delegates or
yes.
whatever.
Yes.
And so those are the two pressure points. And if Washington wants to say, you know, and the parties like to award their base, the Democratic Party obviously wanted to, foreground the needs and concerns of black people who are, have larger majorities in Democratic Party in South Carolina, and so was doing it that. Since these primaries are largely party affairs, that's why it matters to them.
Well, one other thing about being relevant, it does draw the candidates to your state, and they
right.
do have to address the local federal issues there. And I think that's productive. I would love to have our state, have some of that.
But
what are you
going
to do about
change?
This, that, or the other thing? Information is good. I would know more about how they feel about Washington state issues.
Yeah, I just don't. I don't think there's a drive, and I don't think.
No, there's not
earlier,
a drive.
Yeah,
no, the parties
no
have to approve
to,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Our state, our Democrats, tried to make the case that we have a large Asian Pacific Islander population.
Mm-hmm.
Here we do, 10%. Hispanics are 14%, and they actually tried at one point during that last process to get Washington moved up,
mm-hmm.
but they went with Nevada, which has a huge Hispanic population. But
sure.
there, people see advantages here.
Okay,
it's not phony.
Now this is assuming. That we, because we could talk about when might we vote in 2024, but that's assuming we're going to be still one state by
uh-oh.
Then.
Uh-oh.
Rich is on
segue
the...
Segway that, baby.
Yes. Rich is on the secession beat.
Yeah. I mean, there was a survey a couple of weeks ago that showed, we see these once a year, twice a year, but one in four Washingtonians are down to secede from the Union.
And that's different from splitting in half. That's actually leaving the Union. Because you might be – it's typically Eastern Washington. We think of Eastern Washington Republicans who can't stand all the power being on the West Side. But now we're talking about maybe some Democrats – would like to just be like, can we just have our own little country?
Sovereign nation,
our blue country? Is that right?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's people talk about liberty and getting that second state, but there's long been, or at least since I've been here, the Cascadia movement.
Mm-hmm.
You see those little blue, green, and white flags.
Oregon, Washington, Oregon, what
Vancouver,
Northern California,
BC.
Vancouver.
Yeah. International. We just like
grab a little piece
off.
Of that. Yeah,
It's a seed there. Mm-hmm. That's forever. That's in the water.
Okay. It's been around all over the place. I always think about the state of Jefferson, which is supposed to be the chunk of Northern California, a little bit of Southern Oregon. They've been talking about that for decades. So this, I won't say it's completely new. I think this concept of seceding, creating your own state, creating your own sovereign nation has been around for a long, long time. It's always interesting to see these things. And when you hear that one in four Washingtonians want this, what did that say to you? What does that mean that many people want to do that?
I think it's kind of... quaint, I guess, because counties and parts of states and whole states have been saying, well, if I don't get my way, I want to secede.
Okay.
Or remember Cedar and Freedom counties, Eastern King and Eastern Snohomish counties wanting to get away, Eastern Oregon wanting to be part of Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
This violates, and you're all going to laugh because I'm going to quote Joe Biden.
Okay.
He says, you can't only love your country
when you win.
Yeah.
That won't work. But anyway, it's probably illegal anyway, but it's so fun to talk about.
on the issue of like getting a new state, let's say, out of Eastern Washington, I don't love that idea because, they would get two senators in the U.S. Senate.
Oh, I see.
I don't like the kinds of senators they would get. But I do, and we've seen, and I just don't think it would work out in their
economically.
Favor. Yeah, we saw in Kansas, they got a GOP trifecta. They cut taxes all over the place. Literally the next year, their school schools and roads started crumbling. They're like, how are we going to pay for stuff?
Exactly.
They elected a Democratic governor and then and kept the legislature red and worked out a compromise or whatever to actually turn something.
Who do you think pays most of the taxes that end up getting pushed out to the rest of the state?
King County.
It comes from, you know, Puget Sound counties, King counties.
That's true. I did speak to an Eastern Washington newspaper editor about this not that long ago. And he didn't, I don't know that he was endorsing secession, but he said that the argument that Eastern Washington is so dependent on Western Washington is
incredible.
Overstated. He said that that actually Eastern Washington's economy would be plenty bigger than lots of states. And he said that residents of the great state of Liberty don't need a lot of the spending that the state mandates. And if they decided they did need it, to your point, Rich, they would raise taxes on themselves.
Very good.
That's not going to be popular over there. And you do have to realize that many of the taxes that are collected here are pushed out. I don't know how many of you have spent time staring, and this is says a lot about me, at State Office of Financial Management records that show revenues in.
Let's do that after the show.
Let's do that. It's kind of a fun thing. Mm-hmm. We can do your old show where you do this over a meal of
Great.
Some
mm-hmm.
sort.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah.
But anyway, they show consistently that Puget Sound counties push out revenue to the rest of the state.
Definitely.
I worked in the fine city of Spokane several years ago, the Chicago of the Northwest. Mm. And I think there was always that argument that, you know, we don't want to pay for your ferry boats over there on the west side. You know, we don't want to pay for all that kind of stuff. Mm. And so that argument exists. And I think that's one of the bases here. And could that
roundabouts? This Eastern Washington editor said, you know what they keep building us?
Mm-hmm.
Roundabouts. Where are they coming from? We got pickup trucks.
Yeah. They have the best roads.
We have dirt roads. We have our own septic and wells, and we don't need your government cheese.
Yeah.
Largesse.
Well, I say try that with great fear.
Yeah. Did I interrupt you, Brian?
No. I was just, I think there's something to that. It's that things are getting pushed onto these different places in Eastern Washington. There's a lot of pushback there, too, and I think this is something that's going to continue.
And one more thing that I'll interrupt again. He said that what happens is people flee your rain and your crime and all the hellhole, and they come over here, but they're not detoxed yet. They're still hooked to the government services and spending that they're used to. So then they come over with their money, with their campaign donations, and they lobby to make it more like it is on the West Side, even though we don't need it. The salt of the earth folks over here don't need
I think they're misled on that.
The states that have the most conservative governments that spend the least on the people also have the worst health, the worst affordability concerns. You know, the
worst education systems and transportation systems.
Yeah,
it's not a smart move.
It sounds like the
three of you don't want to secede.
I don't like secessionists, but I get where they're coming from.
Yeah.
And I think what they're pointing at is they're just not kind of seeing the larger picture. Cities don't have enough money to solve the problems that they have to solve. And they have charters that basically prevent them from having a credit card. So where are you going to get the money? From the states. States can't put it on a credit card either. They have to balance a budget. Mm-hmm. The only place you can get the money to solve the problems that your state is facing is from the federal government. And the federal government is a minoritarian institution. All of its institutions are minoritarian except for the House of Representatives. And the place is obviously in lockdown and can't function. They can't even pass laws except through budget reconciliation anymore. Mm-hmm. So until the gridlock and the federal government busts, we're not going to be able to get the money and the resources we need to solve the problems that cities and states are facing.
The cities always seem like that last line of defense to me, and it turns into this emergency situation. Do we want different people served at our, emergency rooms and hospitals or whatever else? It's this whole idea of do you build a fence up at the top of the cliff, or do you build a hospital down at the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's something to be learned from that. I hear what you're saying there. When those dollars are not coming from those upper levels, then the cities are really feeling the strain.
Works into the topic of what about the measure to overturn the state capital gains tax. Mm. Almost a huge number is raised in King County, although a lot of that was Jeff Bezos. I think he was like a third to a half of that tax, and he's now a Florida man, right?
Yeah.
And
so, nice. Yeah.
But
Florida man evades taxes.
Evades taxes.
Right.
But whatever's left also raised in King County and sends out to benefit school districts around the state. So we better keep our caps on here.
Okay, listeners, keep your caps on because we're not done yet with KUOW's Week in Review. A brief break, and then we come right back with more of this good stuff.
What is
You are listening, comma, possibly watching, comma? Is that, would there
yes,
be a
Oxford
comma there?
Comma week, is definitely okay. Needed there.
Yeah. Week in Review, watching because we're on streaming the show on YouTube. We got our laptops out. And listening, you're listening to The Strangers, Rich Smith, political analyst Joni Balter, and Seattle Channel's Brian Callanan. And I'm your host, Bill Radke. Some of the topics we haven't had a chance to get to yet, here we're heading toward the end of the show. I want to let you know that, well, there was really a slew of Boeing news. You could hardly get to all of it. I mean, air travel regulators are trying to understand how that Alaska Airlines door plug blew off. This week, Boeing said, we don't have a record of any repairs we may have done on that. We don't keep work videos more than a month. Alaska Airlines said, it was Boeing's fault. Take us off the lawsuits. Boeing pointed out that Alaska still flew the plane even after warning lights came on. Yes,
well,
Joni.
So look, this term is overused, and I know that, but this really is an existential crisis for Boeing. You know, this is one bad blow after another, and everyone's watching the skies. This plane was diverted, tire fell off, all that good
they
stuff.
They used Dawn liquid soap
they
to
use soap,
lubricate.
They don't take pictures. Mm-hmm. They got
a hotel key
federal
card.
Criminal probe. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. You know, and the old line, when you're in a hole, do stop digging. And so Boeing really needs to get its act together here to get the records that the investigators are looking for, do that in a transparent way, and try to stay out of the headlines.
And the damage.
When your airplane door has a hole, stop breathing.
That's yes. One way to look at it. Sure.
Yes,
I was just going to say the relationship between Alaska and Boeing, which used to be, you know, kind of marching in lockstep on a lot of different issues, to see this split like that, that's the part of it that really is interesting to me. I mean, what happens?
By the way, I always have to say my wife works at Boeing.
Fair.
Just so you know.
Okay.
But
got it.
Yes. Alaska and also United saying, you know what, Boeing, that plane that's not even certified yet, the MAX 10, you should probably just stop building those.
Mm-hmm. We're not buying that thing.
And these are the main customers.
Yep. So it's not just what we're talking about right now with these court cases, but all of the financial implications and safety implications that go on for the next several years. So, yeah, this is something where we're going to see these headlines, a flood of them, and it's important to try to sort them out. But these relationships with the actual buyers of the planes, that's what I'm really paying attention to.
You want to hear what passes for good Boeing news these days?
Let's hear it.
The 787 going to New Zealand this week that suddenly lost altitude and hurt dozens of passengers. The New York Times says, it looks like a flight attendant serving a meal hit a switch on one of the pilot's seats that pushed them forward, causing them to push the aircraft's nose down.
Come on.
So it's good news that the flight attendant was out of line and that we called
it. Was not an instrument failure.
And no one was on mushrooms, from what I can tell.
Yes.
So, yeah.
More leg room for pilots, please.
That's the answer we're looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yikes. Okay. Other stories this week that you might want to know about. COVID meets the Seattle Supersonics. In the 1990s, the Sonics' nemesis was the Utah Jazz and their Hall of Fame guard, Gonzaga grad John Stockton. Gonzaga once suspended Stockton's season tickets because he refused to wear a COVID mask at games. Stockton also spread nonsense about vaccines. This week, Stockton and a group of doctors sued our state attorney general's office over pandemic rules that bar doctors from publicly spreading COVID-19 misinformation, including in newspaper editorials. And KUOW's excellent local daily news magazine, Soundside, very helpfully interviewed an Indiana University expert on free speech rights. And he said he is not defending misinformation, but John Stockton makes a not unreasonable argument because it's one thing to regulate what doctors tell patients in the clinic, and it's another to regulate their public speech. So this is not necessarily a hopeless challenge.
There may be a free speech case here, but John Stockton, for all the reasons you just mentioned, is probably the wrong person to be the messenger on it. Mm. And I think he's lost credibility. He said something like, athletes were going to drop dead or were dropping dead
yes.
by the hundreds.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
evidence of this. He
Much
lost
mocked.
A lot of credibility. Yeah. He shouldn't be the one sort of deciding whether this is a free speech issue or not.
He won't decide it.
Right. Just a celebrated alumni of Gonzaga, but it's just something that the thing that really blew me away about this, the different concerns had over COVID, et cetera, wouldn't even attend games at his alma mater when his son was on the team.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like there's a real jarring disconnect here that I don't completely understand. And yeah, I think it's unfortunately this is a superstar of our state, and he's turned into a lightning
Perhaps
rod of controversy.
Was a superstar.
I'm not a
yeah.
doctor, but it sounds like he's got worms in his brain.
Heyo,
can I say that? Free speech?
That was
my feeling.
I think you just did. I think you just did. Right.
Get him on a round of anti.
Don't drop that microphone, but I see you about to do that.
What is it yeah. with jocks and anti-vax stuff? Aaron Rodgers joined yeah. the RFK ticket because, you know, we got to stop having vaccines mm-hmm. or whatever, and now this Gonzaga guy.
Yeah.
I don't understand. What's the connection? Bill, tell me.
The Spokaneites in my life are all done with John Stark.
Yeah.
Former Sonic star Detlef Schrempf said he was bat-ass crazy. But I'm not endorsing
right.
that. I'm just talking about basketball now.
Well,
okay,
no.
In other news, there's a sale on polluting. Our state auctions off the right to emit carbon, and the price plummeted this week to half of what big polluters paid in December. The experts say it's the uncertainty around the future of our state's climate policy. There's a Republican-backed initiative coming to our fall ballot that could repeal the state's carbon cap and auction system, so maybe the oil and gas companies are less inclined to buy credits they might no longer need. In other news, our state legislature passed the so-called Stripper's Bill of Rights. We've told you about that, aimed at making strip clubs safer and less exploitative. Rich, some prosecuting attorneys want the governor to veto part of that.
Yeah, there's a section that would prevent King County, basically, and Seattle from making rules around basically lap dances and what the dancers can wear when they're walking around the club. Right now, lap dances or private dances are illegal, as is. You can only be nude on stage. The second you step off the stage, if you don't immediately throw on a tracksuit, let's say, then you can get a ticket. From
kind of risque.
And you also can't
like
a pull-away tracksuit.
Tear-away.
You know, it could be whatever. You just got to cover up. Otherwise, a cop can come in and hit you over the head and give you a ticket.
Yeah. You can't take the customer's money right there on
the
spot, which is kind of what
part.
A lap dance usually is. Mm-hmm.
Precisely, right. They have to wait until afterwards, after the dance, to accept the money. Currently, the prosecutors essentially want to retain that power, since 10 out of 11 Washington strip clubs are in King County, that they were sort of included in the law as the place where they can where we can have this restriction, where we want to remove their ability to impose those restrictions. The dancers say, the prosecutors say this is going to help us cut down on sex trafficking. The dancers say, nah.
And that it's dangerous. Then that the exposure and the right they're saying that it's not safe for dancers. Isn't that what the prosecutor's saying? Half of it?
The letter to the governor only mentioned that it would probably it would help them combat sex trafficking. They didn't include any evidence in the letter that I saw, but that was their main claim.
Mm-hmm.
King County felt singled out. Lisa Mannion, yeah. King County prosecuting attorney, felt singled out, mm-hmm. and so was kind of threw up a local control argument initially, and mm-hmm. then decided against it. The dancers say, "Look, if you're asking us, the
yeah.
reason why we put this in the bill." was because if we can't take money up front, then we have to wait until we until after the dance in order to take the money. And that means that we have to put up with a lot of abuse
yep.
and
yeah.
bullcrap.
I think the yeah, money's yeah. the toughest
And not
part.
Paying.
I think the money's got to
yeah,
be
potentially
the toughest
not
part here.
And also, because you've criminalized so many of our behaviors in the club, we don't want to be forthcoming about bad stuff that happens in the club, because then a cop will come, and if a cop comes, they might see me doing one of these things you criminalized
right.
and then pick me up too. So that's where the section is coming from, and the King County prosecutor wants to maintain their powers.
I just think this whole establishment of this new state law has confused a lot of people.
Yeah.
And essentially what was done, as I understand it, was this whole concept of lewd conduct that's contained in there was basically torn down. We got rid of the law. It wasn't changed. It was basically we're starting from scratch on that. And I know the Liquor and Cannabis Board is starting to work on some of those laws right now to try to guide this discussion here. But I think there's so many moving parts with this right now. This legal piece is going to be a really interesting one to watch. And then introducing liquor into the different establishments, how's that going to look? And I think it's basically a law that's kind of reinventing itself right now. And we're watching it in real time.
It's historic. Like. Yeah, it's the first stripper's Bill of Rights in the nation.
Yep.
It's a huge deal, and it's going to transform the industry.
Yep. Folks, we got 2 minutes left in the show. It's time to wrap it up. So I'll have to tell them, Rich, you wrote about a Seattle newsstand, at least it used to function as a newsstand, on 3rd and Pike for decades, being removed from the city. It's in the Stranger. Joni, we'll have to talk about the Seattle freeze another time.
Okay.
Because I'm freezing the show. Because
it's getting warmer outside, in case you haven't noticed.
It is getting warm. Is that what you're smiling about, Joni? This is the time
I'm not allowed to use that. I was going to be all over the comedians.
Oh, what are you smiling? Who's
the smile
comedian?
At comedians because I need them more and more.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I understand Daily Show Desi Leidick is coming to town. And she can make me smile, and they make you smile about all the other bad news we have to deal with all week long.
That's what this segment is for. Is there anything else worth smiling about this week?
I thought it was very smile-worthy to talk about Snake Patrick's Day. Shout out to Axios for throwing this one out there. It's at Lake Sammamish State Park in Issaquah from 1 to 2 on Sunday. St. Patrick, why did you drive the snakes out of Ireland? They're an important part of our ecosystem. That's the message we're trying to get across here.
Lines up with worms in the brain.
Yeah.
Yes, it
Look
does.
Out. Yeah, you never know.
Snake Patrick Day. Anything, Rich?
I'm smiling about the Pacific Northwest Ballet's premiere of Alejandro Cerruto's 1,000 Pieces. It's a gorgeous ballet based off Marc Chagall's Windows in Chicago. I don't know if you've seen them, but it's quite beautiful. And they were, it's a huge, gorgeous ballet, and they were about to premiere it, and then COVID-19 happened, and then they had to stop, and they had to throw away 6 weeks of rehearsal, tons of investment, and now we'll finally get to see it on stage this weekend and next at McCall Hall.
At McCall Hall. Excellent recommendation. I'll just say, did you hear about the State Ferry Rescue? Another one, a 37-foot cabin cruiser. 6 people, 2 dogs aboard, hit rough seas off the San Juans, started sinking. They managed to tell the Coast Guard where they were before their radio got swamped and shorted out. The pilot of the State Ferry Sammamish heard about it and maneuvered the ferry to protect the boat from wind and waves. Ferry crew launched a rescue boat and helped the Coast Guard save everybody. It reminded me of the King County water taxi that threw itself in front of the runaway tug headed for the waterfront. How can there be a ferry crew hiring shortage when you get to be a superhero regularly?
Paw Patrol. They're Paw Patrol.
That's some dangerous work, but well done. Yeah.
Well done. And well done, panel. Great show this week, and I want to thank all my guests, Joni Balter, political analyst, contributing columnist, The Stranger editor, Rich Smith, Seattle Channel host and producer, Brian Callanan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bill
Thanks.
Hanks.
Fun.
Should we do this again? Am
sure.
I wrong?
Sounds like a plan.
Was it just me? Okay. All right. Good.
Time.
We'll do it. Thank you to Kevin Kniestad, who produces the show. I'm Bill Radke, and we will see you again next week. Bye. Kathy Faulkner running the board, by the way. Nice job, Kathy Faulkner. Okay. See you next week.